Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age's final recap episode of The Gathering Storm. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be here, finally getting this one wrapped up. And also with us for this episode is Spencer.
Hi, everyone. It is great to be here. This is kind of forebodingly, or maybe not so much, this is the 13th recap episode that we're doing for The Gathering Storm. So lucky number 13, you know, Forsaken, 13 months in the year, 13 channelers needed to still or sever a person. So, you know, the 13, it's very symbolic. And I would love to say that we planned this out, but I'm not that good. Maybe one of you two is, but I'm not.
Well, and isn't it 13 books in the main sequence coming in?
Oh, yep, that too.
Towers of Midnight, coming soon.
Yes.
Can't wait.
And this is great because not only are we getting them done on time, getting the actual recordings done on before the book comes out, but because of the awesome, amazing editors that we have, I say I because I'm the editor-in-chief, and so I'm kind of in charge of them. But because of the awesome editors that we have, they will actually get out to you on time. They might just come as a huge block that you'll just have, you know, 13 two-hour podcasts to listen to, but...
And they
too
will.
Bad.
Yes, they will come as a large block because I actually, as this episode was recorded, just had word from our esteemed host and founder of DragonMount.com, Jason Denzel, who has got the podcast capability nearly up and running on the new servers, which was unfortunately very unfriendly to podcast pages. So that's been the major holdup lately. We've been recording two and three times, sometimes even a week, trying to get this done, but we haven't been able to post anything since the server changeover, and that was unfortunate, but it was one of Swan's unintended consequences.
Yes, well, before we jump right into Chapter 47, we need to take care of a couple of housekeeping items. First off, we need to thank Encyclopedia Watt for the meat of the summaries that we're going to be using for each of the chapters that we're going to give before we actually go into the discussion. And a lot of other information that we get from them as we're going. Encyclopedia-watt.org is a wonderful resource of Wheel of Time knowledge.
Absolutely. It's a great, great resource and a lot of fun to go through. They keep it updated constantly, and it's beyond cool. You just got to go check it out. That's Encyclopedia-watt. It's actually Encyclopedia-watt.org. Can't forget the dash.
The other thing that we need to take care of is...
What is with all this racket?
It's a spoiler warning, my lord. Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series that is vast and quite large, and there may be listeners that have not yet completed the series.
Are you saying that I have...
Of course not. My lord is wise and all-knowing. But if there were people listening that have not yet finished the Wheel of Time series, they would be advised to stop now or risk the chance of spoiling parts of the series they have not read.
Ah, I see. Well, I do remember I have a bit of business to take care of on the other side of...
Of course, my lord will do as he must. I will stand guard.
We'll start off with Chapter 47, The One He Lost. It is from Rand's point of view. After returning from the failed meeting with the border landlords, Rand spends hours walking through the Stone of Tyr. Rand thinks of himself as something artificial and not really human. He had two hands, one to save and one to destroy, and wonders which one he lost. A small voice in his heart disagrees with what he has become. Seeing Hiran made him melancholy for old times when Matt mocked him and he thought he would marry Egwene. He sees a vision of Perrin in a dark camp under a sword statue, and then Matt in a city that looks like Camelin. He can barely feel Elaine through the bond. Falme changed him. He realized he could never go back. He set out to Tyr alone, seeing Eshamiel in his dreams. That has happened again. He reaches the heart of the stone where Kalimdor hung, and wonders about the sword. It is an inferior Saungriel because of its flaw, yet it is in the prophecies and the Choten Call is not. He wonders where Kudswane has hidden the sword. He must be strong, but he cannot control the anger within him. Everyone is defying him, and his plans are unraveling. He failed when he tried to use Kalimdor against the Seanchan, but he has a better tool now. He only needed a fraction of its power to destroy Grandal and all of Natron's Barrow. He will make a strategic strike and take out all the Seanchan command and army in Ebudar. Luthuren recognizes a hallway as he walks through it, the place where he had tried to use Kalimdor to bring the dead girl back to life. Moraine had stopped him then. He cannot bring life, but he is very good at bringing death. He tells the maidens following him to gather a strike force. They are going to battle. He returns to his rooms and finds Tam waiting for him. Jonduin was his real father, but he was raised by Tam. Rand asks how Tam got there from the Two Rivers, and Tam tells him that he was with Perrin. Rand assumes Nynaeve went to the statue and brought back Tam. Perrin has been balancing the Seanchan, the Prophet, the White Cloaks, and the Queen. Morghace, it turns out, is alive. Rand apologizes for losing Tam's sword, and Tam says that he earned it when he killed a man who needed killing, but he still never forgave himself for it. Rand tells Tam that he feels like a puppet, but Tam chastises him. He may not be able to choose what he does, but he can choose why he does it. Tam accidentally lets it slip that it was Kadswain who came to him, not Nynaeve, and Rand reacts in a blind rage, nearly killing Tam with balefire. As the weaves are forming, he is taken by a horror of what he is doing and instead opens a gateway to Ebudar.
That whole chapter is so creepy. I don't even know where to start.
Well, you know, honestly, it was one of the most touching things in the world, at least for me, because we had, you know, all this stuff. I mean, Rand's going through the hall and, you know, all of these old memories from the early books are coming back, and it's almost like you're sort of reading those portions of the chapter again. Up into and including that, you know, the entire incident with the little girl that he tries to revive. You're thinking of it, and then, you know, he makes that resolution. He's going to strike at the Seanchan, which, of course, you know, in my mind went, bad idea, bad idea, bad idea. And, you know, tells the, you know, readies the maidens for a strike, you know, a strike unit, which I'm trying to figure out the purpose behind, because he's not going to use them, even if he did, you know, even if he did assemble them, he's not going to actually utilize them for anything. He's just going to go there and he's going to blow the crud out of everybody with the one power. This is his natural.
You think about the Maiden Zone. They've constantly been annoyed at him.
For
leaving them behind when he goes off on his little jaunts to wherever.
And so
I think it was more a matter of they needed to go with than he needed them to go with.
Yeah, but I mean, I can't see them really taking it any better that he, you know, is going to take them into battle but not let them do anything. I mean, you know, it's not exactly the same thing. And then, of course, you know, right after we have this, you know, he walks into the room and, you know, there's Tam standing there. I mean, there have been pulls on Dragonmount, you know, for when we finally think the reunion between Rand and Tam is going to go. And, you know, it's such a wonderful scene because you've got Tam and Rand acting horribly awkward around each other. Like, you know, Rand tries to do this, like, formal stuff because he doesn't want to possibly endanger Tam any more than he already is by being associated with Rand. And at the same time, you know, Tam's like kind of, well, you know, you don't need your dad, you know, around poking into things, and which of course Rand does. He desperately needs Tam poking around and telling him that he's an idiot because nobody else is able to do it right now. So
I've decided that what Rand really needs is a Tarungrail that he can keep in his pocket that will make a little chime periodically and announce, bad career decision in progress in 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, we've got this, and everything's going really well. And it just, you know, suddenly, and it's not Tam's fault. You know, if he'd been apprised of what was happening, then it wouldn't have been an issue, and he could have been like, you know, he could have just done what needed to be done to help Rand. And instead, you know, they don't, you know, the Aes Sedai don't give him enough information. He, you know, just casually mentions that blasted woman or something like that. And, you know, Rand's like, who? And, you know, he's like, well, Cad's Aes Sedai. And, you know, and suddenly it goes downhill. And it goes downhill so sharply that, like, suddenly it's like, you know, he throws Rand or throws Tam across the room with air. And, you know, and then it just, he's ranting and raving and suddenly so catastrophically different. And, you know, the weaves are just, they're forming and you're like, you're not going to Balefire Tam. Tell me you're not going to Balefire. You're going to Balefire Tam.
Oh,
and then
my God.
Thankfully, you know, that little voice that we have in our head is suddenly in Rand's head and he's like, oh my God, what am I doing? And, you know, that desperation that I can just see the gateway opening and him throwing himself through it. And it just, you know, so much happens that it's all just packed in there. And
I know. Isn't that so typically Aes Sedai that they set up this meeting? They go to all this trouble to set up this meeting and then they don't do the proper groundwork to make sure that it goes well. I mean, if Rand had known that they were bringing Tam, well, he might have complained and whined about it, but then part of him would have been really excited because he's reflected several times that he wished he could see Tam again, you know, in his mind. He would have been really happy and excited, and if they'd prepared Tam properly, now, don't mention this, and, you know, he's got a really sharp temper now, so don't do that, you know. That could have gone so well, you know, and Tam could have easily slipped into the role of advisor and, you know, it could have just gone really well, and I could see Tam becoming an intermediary to get him and Cad Swain back together again, because I could see Min and Tam forming an alliance to keep Rand, you know, calm and on the straight and narrow very easily. I mean, they would have gravitated to each other, I think, instantly, but it didn't happen.
Along that vein, I have to wonder what Tam's reaction is going to be when he realizes that his son is in love with 3 different women.
That's a good one.
I think Tam will take it with his usual calm aplomb. He's a pretty, you know, he's a little like Gareth Bryn. He just sort of rolls along. Nothing really, you know, freaks him out. He's just steady and like a rock. You know, he doesn't really, all that stuff just kind of washes over him. He might think it in his heart. Gee, you know, what did I raise here? And he might have a few words with him, but I think he'd take it better than you might think. He's a practical man above all else. And you know, the rules aren't the same for the Dragon Reborn as they are everyone else. Even Nynaeve had to accept it. And you know how she is.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Nynaeve's reaction to it and wonder how much Tam's will be the same, even if he doesn't show it externally.
Probably won't have an apoplexy like she almost did.
I was a little surprised in here to see Rand's, like, almost complete lack of reaction to the news that Morghese is alive. I mean,
yeah.
Like I said, nearly no one knows, which, you know, is terribly surprising to me. It's like, really?
Okay.
But,
again, along those lines, I have to wonder, I know that we've seen that Rand has seen Galad with Perrin, so we know that she was found by her stepson. But I have to wonder beyond that if Tam would have recognized her at any point in time. I mean, he was fairly, for a Two Rivers man, he was really worldly. I mean, he had gone out, he had joined Ilion's army, but I can't imagine that he had done that without going through Andor at some point in time. or going through Camelin or something, possibly at least seeing her. I don't know.
Very possible. Very possible. And it is kind of funny to reflect on how we're so used to knowing firsthand the faces and voices of every powerful figure and celebrity in the world. I mean, you know, we know the faces of dozens of people we will never flesh. And they, obviously, in those days, just they didn't even have that possibility. There weren't even, you know, drawings circulated. There were newsletters or anything else. They relied on peddlers to verbally bring them information. You know how mentally isolated that made everybody. It's hard for us to imagine now. I mean, I can still imagine that because I was a kid, but I can remember when there was no television and most people didn't have them. And you had to depend on was radio and newspapers. You know, well, if you don't happen to pick up a newspaper and see a picture, you're never going to see their picture unless you go to the library. You know, weird.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just when you think of the changes that we've had in the last, you know, 20, 30 years, it's astonishing. And I think it's becoming harder and harder for us to relate on an emotional level to people that lived in, you know, a medieval type culture because it's just inconceivable to us that they don't have instant communication, you know, widespread knowledge of world events and people and everything. I mean, we accept it and we slip into it, but we don't resonate with it on a personal level anymore. You know, but not like, you know, when I first started reading fantasy, there was no internet. I mean, you still had TV, newspapers and radio and all that, but the internet has just blew doors off of all that. And cell phones. Oh my God. Smartphones. This story couldn't have happened, really. I don't think in the same way at all if there had been smartphones. One other thing I wanted to say, one of the reasons that I thought this chapter was kind of creepy in a way, not only his reaction to Tam and his instant anger and almost killing him, I couldn't even believe that. Has anybody really noticed how quickly and precipitously Rand has slipped from not wanting to kill a woman and even grieving over the man that he's killed in battle, but he's just slipped right into the role of mass murderer. I mean, he's out there bale firing Natron Sparrow and all the people within, male, female, children, horses, whatever, you know, gone. Now he's planning to wipe out the entire Shan Chan army and command, officers, soldiers, Soldam, Damani, horses, cats, dogs, whatever. It's the nuclear option. We're done. He's just slipped right into that role as though he'd been doing it all of his life. And that to me, I mean, I realize that this is, you know, the nadir of his descent, the absolute bottom of his slipping into cold, hard madness. But wow, that was just like that last step down just went real quick.
Yeah, no kidding.
Thanks, yeah. Nukem.
Yeah, he slipped right down. You know, I think it's interesting. I don't remember exactly what book it is that we started to really hear and get to know as a character, Luz Theron, the voice in Rand's head. I know he first showed up in one of the really, really early books. But I find it interesting that it's Luz Theron who recognizes the place where he tried to bring the little girl back to life. It wasn't Rand. It was Luz Theron, the creepy, crazy guy inside his head who, for the most part, in this book, who in this book seems to be the more sane among the two.
And isn't that scary?
Yeah, which, of course, leads to my pet theory of somewhere along the line, the personality that was Luz Theron and the personality that was Randall Thor traded places and they didn't realize it. Because Rand seems to be acting a whole lot more like the Kinslayer here. Not like the Luz Theron Telamon the Dragon, but more like when he actually became the Kinslayer is the way that Rand seems to be acting to me. And Luz Theron is acting much more much more sane, actually, which is scary when you think about it because he's not sane at all, but he is acting more sane than we had seen him in previous books. And then, of course, there's the little voice, which in my mind is what's left of Randall Thor, the sheep herder from the Two Rivers.
Yeah. Don't like what you're becoming.
Yeah.
So how many personalities does he have in his head now? Let's see. He's got at least three of his own. He's got four different warder bonds. He has Morden. He has his bond with Matt and Perrin. What else?
Like Grand Central Station in there.
Oh, yeah. It's a busy place. It's happening.
I keep waiting for all the voices of the women he's killed to start chiming in his head. You know, he won't stop beating that drum. Or...
yeah, the first time he meets Moraine, he thinks it's a voice in his head because he doesn't see her.
Rand, you killed me. Rand, you killed me.
She's just talking to him behind his back, and he thinks she's a voice in his head. And then he turns around, and there she is. Oh my!
What do you think was going on with the? They even make, you know, even at the chapter title, the reflection about one hand to save and one to destroy, which do we lose? What do you think is really going on with that reflection?
Why
does he have to have one to save and one to destroy?
No, I think it might just, you know, be that facet of him. It is just his own thought on his role in the world. I mean, I don't really know that there's necessarily a direct correlation. I don't think we've seen anything from the prophecies which, you know, specifically state anything that way. I mean, maybe there is, but, you know, I really do think that he's taken somewhat with his own philosophy, which I think may be another indication that we have Morden slipping in here and influencing Rand in a deep and significant way.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. I'm actually thinking about that is kind of creepy in and of itself because, as we know, Ashamiel was never considered sane, even by the other Forsaken. So there's another crazy person in his head. How many crazy people in his head does he need? And, I mean, you can't even be around people in your life, you know, just friends and neighbors and stuff like that, without being affected by them. Having somebody in your head has got to be, you know, as Spencer was saying earlier, there's a lot of leakage back and forth, it appears to me. And why is he reflecting that Falma changed him? That's so long ago that any change like that, he's had so many more since then. And now he's seeing the Ashamiel in his dreams again.
Yeah, well, I mean, that it is partially resultant from the bond that they formed when they balefired each other's balefire.
Don't cross the streams. It would be bad.
Exactly. I mean, it's now even more unconscious.
Yeah.
Than it was before, so...
We need an Egon in here. You know, one of the things that's kind of struck me, too, is that it seems like he's, at this point, losing a lot of the sort of spiritual and psychological anchors that he's had, people that have sort of kept him a little more grounded. I think Lon was a really good influence on him in the fact that he's just, you know, he just doesn't go off the handle. He's calm, he's reasoned, you know, he's practical. I think he was a very stabilizing influence on Rand. And I think the emotional pulling back of Min at this point has sort of hurt him a little bit, too. I mean, she isn't doing it because she wants to, sort of because he's done it. But, you know, still, there's a little distance there between them. You know, he's lost Moraine. She was a really stabilizing influence, although that's been a long time now. And then, you know, Cadswain, of course, he pushed her away. Even though he didn't have that much contact with Varen, I thought she was another sort of grounding influence when she was near him. She's gone. He had the possibility of Tam. That's gone. You know, and it's like, who has he got left to really keep him grounded? He's sort of just in his head, you know, the water's sort of swirling around in the bowl, going down. You know, he just doesn't seem to have any breaks anymore. At least he still retains enough of his, you know, sanity to be horrified that he almost killed his father. Well, his stepfather, but whatever.
True.
We mentioned Morgaze, who recognized her. So she was still incognito and basically hiding. How come all of a sudden, oh, it's Morgaze now?
That one's a really easy answer when you think about the idea that Perrin has to be, well, like Tam says, he's been balancing the Shanshan, the Prophet, and the White Cloaks. Well, we haven't seen him with the White Cloaks yet. Except in one of the flashes that Rand had of him and Galad, who would recognize Morgaze and Lenny, and no matter what they were dressed as.
Yeah, so it was probably Galad that tipped everybody off. It would be the right thing to do.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, Tam really kind of rolled in for the battle. He hadn't been around a whole lot prior to that, if my memory is serving properly, it is very possible that at some point, because you meet Morghese, like really meet her, and you probably don't forget. And I mean, like I said, Tam's had enough distinction, he's traveled the world enough, you know, I could almost see him knowing, but, you know, not saying anything because, well, I mean, it doesn't need to be said.
I think they do mention here in the notes as well that the mention of Perrin juggling the white cloaks as well is a little sort of flash forward to preview of events to come in the next book, and I suspect that that's in part because Brandon had originally started writing this with all these arcs contained in one volume and had to split them up, and I imagine that it, as good as he is, he probably didn't untangle every single thread or just decided to leave it in, you know, as a teaser for the future, one of the two.
Yeah, the way Brandon talked about it when I was lucky enough to, you know, do the Stormleader thing last year, you know, there are four major plot arcs. There's the Rand, Matt, Perrin, and other characters. And he said that in this book, he's going to get two of those plot arcs, three quarters of the way to the last battle. And the other two, he's going to get a quarter of the way. And then in Towers of Midnight, he's going to get the other two, the last three quarters, which to get them to all the way. And then the first two, the last quarter. So I think there is going to be a lot of flashing back when you think about the series chronologically, especially with Perrin's point of view. I think we're going to see a lot of mentions to the depressing clouds that have since lifted and, mm-hmm. and other things like that.
Yeah.
Because he's way behind.
Yeah. Well, there was crossover between, obviously, this book and the next one. Well, we've seen those who have read the prologue and the first chapters 1 and 8 will know that there is some time crossover between the two books, and I'm sure that will be in the next two as well. Okay, so I think that will pretty much wrap up chapter 47 at this point in time, and we're going to move on to chapter 48, which is called Reading the Commentaries. And this is from Min's point of view, and we find her in Cadswain's room with Nynaeve, Corell, Maurice, and Belvine. Min feels pain and anger through her bond to Rand. She is reading the Commentary on the Dragon by Fagius. Arian, Missouni, Serene, and Valdine are not very welcome near Rand anymore, so they have joined Cadswain's camp. The only Aes Sedai he sees anymore is Nynaeve. And then Min reads, "He shall hold a blade of light in his hands, and the three shall be as one." Min makes a comment that she thinks this interpretation is wrong. Valdine sniffs, and Cadswain demands to know what Min thinks. Moraine told Min that Aes Sedai practice exerting control. The interpretation is that the three are three nations. But Rand only has one crown, and Darlan has the crown of Tyr. It means something about how he must use Kalendor. Cadswain tells her that she is right and suggests that Belvine apologizes. Belvine leaves in a huff, and Carlden follows from a side chamber. That very passage had led Cadswain to initially investigate Kalendor, and she has learned that it can only be used safely by a circle of three, two women and one man. Nynaeve paces, worried about Lan. Min has a viewing of her at the time. At this moment, Min has a viewing of Nynaeve. She was kneeling over someone's corpse in a posture of grief. And then she also had a viewing of Valdine, a black knife spun around her head. Min says something is still wrong with the interpretation, something they have not discovered, and Cadswain agrees. At that moment, Tam bursts into the room in a fury. He demands to know what Cadswain did to Rand. He says Rand tried to kill him. Min is terrified, thinking of her own experience with Rand, but that had been Semirog, not him. Tam tells Cadswain that she has a lot to explain, and she wraps him up in air. He tells her that she is a bully, and that irks her enough that she puts him back down. They argue, but Min senses that Rand is gone. The others ask where. She says that he has gone to Ebedar to destroy the Shanshan. Well, I think these viewings are probably the most interesting thing to me at this point. I have no idea how to interpret some of these either.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, the viewing with Nynaeve is... She's kneeling over someone's corpse in a posture of grief. I mean, obviously, or the obvious possibility is Lan there, but we all hope and pray that it'll be someone else that she cares about enough to kneel over like that, but that isn't Lan, because if it's Lan, I'm going to throw the book across the room and then go pick it up and keep reading. Anyway.
Well, I mean, there's the possibility that it's Lan. There is also the possibility that it's Rand, because, you know, again, there's apparently something that is in the vision that is keeping her from identifying said corpsified person.
I like it. You've been corpsified.
So, you know, there's kind of equal weight to who it might be. And, yes, I truthfully hope that it is not Lon because, you know, there's just, I don't know, there's so much potential for at least, you know, a temporary happy ending that it would just be a shame to lose such a great character and story arc all in one kind of go like that. Unless, of course, it leads to, you know, her becoming so aggrieved that she does somehow manage to learn to bring people back using the one power if they've not died a natural death and therefore, you know, is able to restore Rand via her, you know, her change because of what she had to do for Lon.
Well,
she'll figure out how to use anti-balefire.
Or, you know, going off of Virginia's favorite theory, you know, she could be channeling something that isn't the true source, that is somehow, you know, akin to the true power, but on the other side of the spectrum. And using that, she can somehow bring people back to life. But no, one thing we have to keep in mind, though, when we're thinking about the Lon Nynaeve storyline, is that Lon is not Aragorn and Malkier is not Gondor. You know, the possibility of him restoring Malkier, it isn't actually in my mind, because that's not the kind of story that Robert Jordan has written. However, that doesn't mean that Lon is going to die. That just means he's not going to restore Malkier.
Well, we don't know that he won't. I mean, a lot of the, you know, experiences that they had in the, you know, accepted in Aes Sedai testing have proven out to be true foreshadowings, or at least partially true, and one of those was certainly that Nynaeve and Lon were king and queen of Malkier, and also that they had Shireena Malkoy, or whatever her name was, who showed up in Saladar as probably the oldest living novice. I mean, it's possible. I can't rule it out. It would certainly be a nice happy ending. I think there are going to be darn few of them in this book, so I hope we get one or two. I think as far as Nynaeve becoming distraught enough or upset enough to be able to heal somebody who's dead, that is almost in the nature of a narrative debt. That's been foreshadowed and commented and used as a throwaway line so many times in this series of books. Nynaeve would never be happy until she's healed someone 3 days dead, blah, blah, blah. It's been mentioned and mentioned and mentioned so many times. She almost has to do it. I just can't see how that she can't. And obviously, Rand is the prime choice for that, because we know that he has to, you know, to live, he must die. And, you know, how is he going to do that unless somebody brings him back? So, I mean, that's the obvious choice, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't be Lon either. Maybe Lon is the situation which will push her over the edge to do it, so that when the time comes and we have the vision of Minns of the three women in the boat and the three women in the beer, you know, with the dead corpse in the bear or buyer, however you say it, that they will be bringing him to Nynaeve, you know, in true, that's almost like Arthurian fashion, you know, which is almost like the Lady of the Lake or something. But I really think that she's going to be the one to bring him back. It might take her a circle to do it. I mean, she might have to gather together a number of people to link with to do it, but then again, she might not. And maybe that's how Olivia is going to help him die. She may also help him be reborn. But it's just too much. He's got to come back from the dead, and who else is going to do that? You know, twice dawns the day, once to live and once to die. I mean, there's too much foreshadowing. It's almost got to happen. And, you know, of course, there is also the obvious, which nobody ever seems to really mention too much. You know, obviously Rand is a Christ-like figure. He's not only likened to the Fisher King and, you know, the person who sacrifices for his people and et cetera, but there is a Christian sort of Christ-like element to it. And of course, what did he do that was the most spectacular? Rose from the dead.
But, well, enough about Nynaeve, because I don't think we'll ever figure out until we actually read it, that this viewing she has of Beldine, a black knife, spun around her head. This reminds me of the viewings that men had of the tower
or of the Aes Sedai and the tower when she came to Dragon Reborn to give Moraine's message to Suan Sanche of all the Aes Sedai that she knew were going to die, most of them on the same day. Some of them are getting collared and carted off, which, you know, we know comes a couple months later, but still. And this just reminds me of that, so I'm afraid that Beldine is going to die. Either that, or she's a dark friend.
My thought on that, I mean, and this is just from me and, you know, base symbolism, you know, we've got the black knife spinning over her head. For some reason, I seem to feel like the fact that the knife is black tends to indicate towards action by the Dark One. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like maybe she gets Greymaned or something.
Or
I mean, I don't know why they would send.
True. We haven't seen Greyman in a long time.
Yeah, or maybe she is captured and they try to turn her, but they're unsuccessful, which is why the knife is spinning instead of. I mean,
I think a lot of it might be in the knowledge that we don't have. A black knife spun about her head. Well, how is it spinning? You know, my first instinct, honestly, was that it's kind of at an angle. Like a 45 degree angle away from the top of her head and rotating about that way. But you know, it could also be directly above her head spinning 180 degrees. It could be pointing up or down. We don't know. And I think a lot of that knowledge of exactly what the knife looked, what position the knife is in could definitely influence what it means.
Well, it says it spun around her head rather than spun around above her head. So, I don't know. It's interesting, though. Something definitely is going to happen with her that's going to make a difference. And it seems like, as Andrew said, it's probably going to have to do with some agency of the Dark One. Maybe she'll be the one who kills Pat and Fane. That would be weird, huh?
Would be
what would happen if Pat and Fane died? Where would Mashadar go if Pat and Fane died?
To hell, I hope.
That's what he's going to have to do. Rand is somehow going to have to throw Pad and Fane out the boar with the Dark One in order to, and then seal it all up.
What happens if he just does my favorite trick to dispose of dead bodies, opens up a gateway and pushes them through with no platform?
Well, then you get Mach and Shin in the ways. Yes, that's what Mach and Shin
fall,
is.
He would just fall through darkness to eternity. You don't go into the ways.
Mach and Shin. Mach and Shin
you don't fall into the waves. You don't fall into the waves.
Except that the skimming space seems to be fairly similar to the space that the waves exist in. And so I think that Mach and Shin, this is my new theory that I just came up with because I just come up with them on the spot. I don't spend any time building upon them before I release them because that's just the way I am. But Mach and Shin is the souls of all those people who have fallen either in the skimming space or in the ways.
Interesting.
Because the body can only last so long before, you know, the soul has to leave it because the body is dead. And so the souls just get collected into this massive group that is Mach and Shin because obviously, this doesn't exist in the normal world, so they can't go into an afterlife, so they're stuck in the way.
Well, this worldview does seem to have a real propensity for merging together things, so I suppose that's true. I mean, look at how we got two individuals. Luke and Esom became one guy somehow, Slayer, and Pat and Fane merged with Mordeth to become...
4D.
Yeah, and Rand merged with everybody else in the universe to become the nutcase that he is. I don't know. Anything could happen. What about the, this is a really hotly debated one as well. He shall hold a blade of light in his hands and the three shall be one. The commentary that she's reading interpreted that the three are three nations. I think that's wrong too. That's bogus. I think it's either going to be somehow three of Rand's personalities, or...
It's going to be Avienda, Elaine, and Min, and the three will be as one. I don't know what the Blade of Light is.
Well, it could be Kalendor, obviously.
Could be Kalendor. But see, they'll become as one, because they'll become Elenya, and Rand will become Luthien, and we'll be all good.
The three, it doesn't
Either
say
that
the three shall be as one, it says the three shall be one. Not as one. I actually read that wrong. Now that's gonna be a little sticky if Min, Elaine, and Avienda merge into one being.
We know that something's weird about Avienda's four babies.
Well, what's that got to do with the babies? You're talking about the three girls merging into one.
Which would result in weird babies.
Well, that means if she and Avienda merge into one and they're both pregnant, then that means that whoever is left is going to have six. Because Elaine's already
except,
got two. Except
Min can't view herself.
Yep, and Avienda, we know, can't be pregnant because it's been a while. And we don't know about Min yet. We haven't seen that she's pregnant yet, but...
Not, and it's not for lack of trying, believe me.
Yeah.
All right, well, here's my theory, that the three shall be one, and I think this is even crazier. I think it's the three Taveran shall be one is a possibility.
That was set by Yil, Tuan, Elaine, Avienda, and Min. Very much.
Which isn't, it doesn't say it's permanent. It just says that there'll be one. It doesn't say there'll be one forever. They could become, as you know, like one fighting unit because of their color merging communication for the last battle and then go back to being their normal selves. A lot of things are going to change after the last battle. Everybody seems to agree they're going to stop being Taveran once the wheel no longer needs them to be Taveran, right? So
yeah, and I'm pretty sure RJ has actually said that.
Yeah, then they'll just go back to being three regular guys. But in the last battle, they'll basically, because this is unheard of, three Taveran linked together like this. Nobody's ever even heard of that before. So there's Rand with his blade of light, and the other two guys basically become one unit with him to fight the last battle, including the Dark One. It's said over and over again that they need to be near him or he'll fail. Perrin in particular needed to be with him. So they'll marshal their, this is what I think. I just thought of this myself, so I'm not, I haven't put a lot of thought into this either. This is another instant crazy theory. You know, Perrin will summon all the wolves to fight. He didn't necessarily have to direct them. They know what to do. And, Matt will get all of his armies in motion again. He gets them started. They don't necessarily need him to direct them. They'll become linked with Rand through their color viewing or possibly temporarily physically battle the Dark One. And then when all is said and done, they'll not be a unit anymore. I mean, being one can be like a massive link, you know, of some sort. Now, they're not channelers, so they can't link in that way, but they have a Taveran link, and they've got this color link. We know that's got to be something. I mean, it's building up these swirling colors and the visions of each other and everything. It's building up to something. It's either going to be a method of communication for them during the last battle, or it's going to be an actual linkage. I think. Prove me wrong.
Yeah, that could be interesting.
Trimble,
you know,
I've
always kind of assumed that the last battle will end up, if it is actually just one major epic battle, it will end up, Matt is leading all of the actual terrestrial forces, Perrin is leading the forces in Teleron Riad, and Rand is going to Sheol Ghul. With himself and maybe a small strike force indicative of Frodo and Sam. Mm,
that's true, but you know, it could end up being one of these things where, you know, like the Asama, where the heroes came back, they're there and they're not there in a way. You know, they've descended out of Teleron Riad, but they're still pretty magical. I mean, Birgitta's riding across the bay. You know, they're doing things, the arrows don't touch them because they're not there in the physical sense of the world. They're there in a different sense. You know, I'm not explaining that very well, but she explains it, that they weren't, that the, you know, the fireballs and the arrows and everything didn't touch them because they weren't there as normal, you know, people. They were different somehow. And I've really started leaning toward the thought that the whole battle between Rand and the Dark One is going to take place in Teleron Riad, because that's the only place he could do it without breaking the world. Unless there is a way to cause such devastation in Teleron Riad that it actually does affect the physical world. But I think that's got to be one of the reasons why there's been the big buildup that nothing you do in Teleron Riad affects the world when you leave. That he can wreak all the destruction he wants in Teleron Riad to kill the Dark One and not doesn't have to worry about, you know, melting continents or heaving up seas and all those other things. So
he's going to have to go to the Wise Ones and get some training on how to actually utilize the world of dreams without having to channel.
He's done pretty
otherwise,
well,
the dark
actually.
Otherwise, the Dark One will just put him in a dress with no legs and we'll be good to go. You can't
move. Pretty well. Remember, remember when he's running through, oh God, where was it? When he was chasing Robin and Robin
Dota's
and doing all this stuff?
Well, Robin and Camelin, but also in book three, he's chasing Ishmael through the Stone of Tyr.
Yeah, and they're doing all these things. They're altering reality around them. They're turning the air to stone. They're turning the air to water full of piranha, you know, all these things. And he's setting it back right without even thinking how he's doing it. And he already has more skill there than you would think, I think, just by virtue of being the Dragon Reborn. So, yeah, maybe that's part of what Katsue needs to teach him. She's hooked up with Sorlia. Maybe they've figured out that that's a necessity, too, that he needs to learn how to manipulate the world of dreams in order to win. I mean, they agreed to try and teach him laughter and tears, but he's kind of working on that already. Maybe that's the thing that she needs to teach him. But here's where you need to fight the last battle, dude, not in the real world. Because, I mean, let's face it, in the real world, the armies of good are seriously overwhelmed. I mean, the Dark One's been building up hordes of Trollocs and Murdral and who knows what else, Shadowspawn and the Blight and everything in preparation for this. It's going to be like the Borderlands. They're going to be just overwhelmed by a flood of Shadowspawn and won't be able. Even the armies of Aiel aren't a patch on what we understand that they're building up in the Blight. I don't think they can win this, you know, if they just contest it on a real field in the real world, you know, arms and armor, there you go. I don't think we can do it. And we have a lot of channelers now that we didn't have before, and they'll help offset the Dreadlords, but, you know, let's face it, a lot of the channelers are like the Ashram, and they're good, but they're not, you know, hundreds of years of training or whatever from the Age of Legends good. Maybe Lutheran would give some more, no, he's gone now. I was going to say maybe he could give some more cool weaves to Rand that would help, but probably not.
Just because the voice is gone doesn't mean that Rand doesn't still have the memories.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's really a...
There's not much more to talk about in this chapter.
That sums it up, I don't know.
Yeah, we're good. We're good. Let's see. Moving on, chapter 49...
One quick thing I've just got to say. I just love the way Tam Ul'Thor stands up to Cat Swain and says, "You're a bully." You are such a bully, woman. He doesn't care about anything. He's so funny.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. So I guess that'll probably wrap up the chapter. It's moving on.
So we're going to go on now to chapter 49, which is Just Another Man. This is back from Rand's point of view. He has traveled to the gates of Ibudar. He spent the night at a tinker camp outside the city. They were kind to him. They gave him a cloak and a staff, thus fulfilling the prophecies from Perrin and Min about him in rags and a rough cloak with a beggar's staff. The tinkers have gathered near Ibudar because they feel safe with the Shanchan. In the morning, he enters the city to plan his attack, but as he's walking the streets, instead of a conquered, oppressed city, he sees people who are happy and going about their daily business. He sees that Ibudar is much better off than Bandar Iban, where he had just left. He thinks about how he nearly killed Tam, and he can't blame it on Semirog, Lutheran, or anyone else this time except himself. He recalls how even Nynaeve is afraid of him. Lutheran says that death will be a mercy, and at this point he sounds a lot like Rand. He goes to the Tarsan Palace, where the Daughter of the Nine Moons, now the Empress, although he doesn't know it, resides. He sees a side in, and he's going to Balefire the palace with the access key, but the sickness comes on him so powerfully that he collapses. The citizens around him, who do not know that he's a Dragon Reborn, can't tell that he's about to channel, they're concerned for him, and they are going to try and help him. In frustration and self-loathing, he opens a skimming gate, jumps on the black and white disc to the meadow where he fought against the Shanchan with Kalandor to keep them out of Ilion. He stares for a long time, and then he opens another gateway to the top of Dragon Mount. The sky is clouded above him. After weaving air and fire for warmth and breathing, he sits down to think.
Which takes us directly into chapter 50, Veins of Gold. Rand sits on top of Dragon Mount with the access key. It is now midday. He remembers Asmodian trying to teach him a weave that he uses for breathing in thin air. He is angry at the world, the pattern, and the creator for using him. Everything began to go wrong with Moraine's death. before that, he still had hope. He had not been put in a box yet. Rand thinks his fight is meaningless. Morden is right that they are better off destroyed instead of living meaningless, painful lives over and over again. He draws Sadin even more than when he cleansed the taint. He remembers being healed to find Elenya dead by his own hands. Why must he live over and over? Luthuren sounds completely sane when he answers that we live again so that we can have a second chance. Rand remembers Tam telling him that he can choose why he does his duty. If he lives again, then he gets to love again. He wants to do it right this time. He remembers all of the lives he has lived before. He drives the One Power back through the access key to the male Choten call, and it explodes. The One Power winks out. Rand opens his eyes for the first time in a long while. He knows he will never hear Luthuren again, for they are not two men and never were. The clouds overhead break and he can see the sun. He smiles and laughs for the first time in far too long.
That is, every time I even hear the summary of that, it's so amazing. Such a change in such a short time.
Yeah, this set of chapters, it is the very bottom of the low point and the beginning of the turnaround. You know, it's just the idea that I was kind of shocked because, yeah, the people in Ebudar don't realize what's about to happen to them. And I mean, it's going to be complete and utter devastation. And I'm not certain necessarily that it is just the sickness from holding the One Power that keeps him from channeling and you know, causing that destruction in Ebudar. I mean, part of it is, I mean, his mental state at that point is swirling and frenzied and chaotic. And, you know, I think it's just all too much for him and everything shuts down. The sickness is there, but he can't hold on to it. He can't control what's been happening to him. And I think that's significant.
It almost makes me wonder if the sickness that he's been feeling when he sees his sighting all along the last few books isn't really more of a manifestation of his conscience trying to put a rein on him than it is anything else. Never really thought about that before, but he really can't do that kind of damage unless he channels. And so maybe his inner voice that is trying to tell him he shouldn't really be what he's becoming is the one that's causing this sickness to try and basically put some brakes on him. I think it's interesting, too. This is, am I right? This is the first time we've seen Rand visit the Tinkers?
Yep.
Yeah, it is. Visit the living Tinkers, yes. He's been in amongst abandoned Tinker wagons before, covered in blood. But I don't think he's ever actually been with live too often before.
So that means all three of the boys have now benefited from the kindness of the Tinkers. I think that's kind of interesting. I don't know if it's significant. But then what in these books is not significant?
The name of the horse.
Bella?
Although Mandarb was significant.
Well, yeah. Bael tried to be Mandarb, remember? Perrin laughed her out of it.
Yep,
hey, see that horse over there? His name's Mandarb.
And, of course,
you can't be that horse. Sorry.
Yeah, and of course, the stallionship, or lack thereof, of Tyta Shar. That's not important.
Yeah, the on and off. That was just an oopsie. Stallion ship, I liked it. And the geldingness. I wonder, isn't that funny too, you know, when you think about it, how close he was standing outside the terrace and palace, how close he was not only to Balefire and Ebudar, but Matt's wife. I think that might have caused a few problems.
Oh,
if
yeah.
Done it, don't you?
Oh, yeah. That was my biggest problem going into this chapter was, oh my gosh, what is Matt going to do when Rand kills his wife?
What?
Well, and also, I mean, I was just looking through the book at where Rand goes to channel, and yes, well, the sickness comes on him and it is extremely strong. I mean, it says it knocks him down as if, you know, he'd taken a blow to the stomach or something. But what really is interesting to me is that, I mean, when he falls down, you know, he cries out and everything, and he's fighting and struggling to hold on to the One Power. And when the people come around, the line that is right before opening a gateway and you know, disappearing. You know, the people were gathered around him, concerned. A Shanshu patrol was approaching. That was the time he had to strike, but he could not. The people looked so concerned, so worried. They cared. Screaming in frustration, Rand made a gateway, causing the people to jump back in shock. The biggest thing, right before, you know, he finally, you know, breaks off and can't, you know, make this strike, which he's capable of, is the recognizing in the people around him that random people he doesn't know, you know, care that, you know, that this seemingly just another person has collapsed in the street. It's really, really saying something about, you know, the state of not just the people under the Shanshan, but people in general.
Yeah. Well, and you think about it now, this proves that being a good person, you know, can save lives.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's
by
interesting too. I mean,
millions
not only,
of lives.
You know, yeah, the Abu Dhari were basically known for their quarrelsomeness and touchiness. You know, they fight duels with the drop of a hat. And here they are, conquered people, and they still have caring and compassion for a stranger who goes down in the square in front of them and collapses. I mean, if there's anybody that's painted as less full of the milk of human kindness than the Abu Dhari, it's probably the Morandians. They're always painted as being really obnoxious and jerky, but, you know, the Abu Dhari, I mean, like, you know, like Gareth Wynn sends the guys into sends the warders into his camp of soldiers and says, tell him an Abu Dhari tavern maid sent you, you know, you know, an Abu Dhari tavern maid will get you like a fish.
Then when we go into chapter 50, you know, obviously this is really powerful, really important. Rand's has a major turning point, but there are still a few little minutiae that we can go over. One of the notes from Encyclopedia Watt that I hadn't ever really thought of before now, but he's drawing more with the Chosen Call than he drew even when he cleansed the taint. And you remember, when he cleansed the taint, every channeler everywhere stopped and turned and stared, because this is a massive amount of power. So
yeah.
If Rand is on top of Dragon Mount, gathering this much power, every male channeler everywhere is going to stop and turn and say, what the heck is going on there?
And they probably did. So why didn't they all
show up
there? And so
what's that going to mean in the future?
Well, obviously he left before they got there. Surely some of them might have gone to hunt him down, but at least the Forsaken that are left. None of the women
were. Or would they have noticed it? Would they have noticed it as much, though? Because with the cleansing of the taint, he was actually channeling that much of the power. With this one, he was just gathering it into him, and then suddenly he's like, oh, break the Chosen Call. And it was kind of quick and over with the cleansing of the taint. It was a long process and constant channeling of that much of the power for several hours.
Yeah, but remember that when Rand started drawing power to himself, remembering how he did it last time, quote unquote, you know, Loghain standing there is like, he's holding a lot of the power, a lot more.
Yeah,
and I mean, you know, he makes that quip about, you know, yes, I understand you're stronger than me. You know, I mean, it's even, I think, drawing on the power, at least, you know, it's kind of like when the women embrace the source, and that any other woman who can channel around them can see the halo of the power.
Yeah. I think they have to be fairly close to just feel them holding it, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is a lot more.
I'm not sure.
But still, I think they would have noticed this.
And so Ashaman, maybe at the base of Dragon Mountain, maybe for a couple hundred leagues around. But I don't think that every channeler everywhere, or that we've seen, would you know, just turn and say, "What the heck is that?"
Well, I think they might have.
I don't think without the channeling. I don't think without the channeling it would have been it would have been the same kind of beacon that the cleansing was.
No, but when he exploded the Chosen Call, he sent all that amount of Sidene into the statue. First of all, it had to have gone off like a bomb near Karyan, so all those people noticed the physical effect of the statue. But I would have thought that it would have been the equivalent of a nuclear bomb going off to somebody who was watching a monitor screen to tell. I mean, they had to have felt that huge blast of the power, even if the duration wasn't long.
Yeah, but in that case, the focus of the power would be on the statue in Kyrian and not on Rand.
Maybe, but they might have been able to tell where he was when he did it.
Yeah. It depends on how the Chun call work. I don't know. I do have to wonder how many people were around when he exploded the statue and if they died or not. If it was still under guard like it was when he saw it in Great Hunt or not, I don't know.
So now it's down in the bottom of a big hole. It's an even bigger hole.
Yeah, it's a huge hole now.
Yeah.
At least it didn't melt like the one on Trimalki.
I don't know which would be worse.
Cause people to. I wonder why. I wonder if it's just because the female one wasn't used to the taint and so couldn't handle it, or why it melted. If there was too much power pulled through, which I couldn't understand, because if it wasn't built to handle as much of the power as much of Sadar as the male Chosen Call was to handle Sadin, what would cause it to just melt, and then all the tree-mocking people to kill themselves?
Well, I think probably the melting had more to do with the extended duration. They were made for weapons. I don't know if they were ever made for use hour after hour on end the way he did cleansing the taint. I think it might have been
accumulative. But the Melchion Call was used the same amount of time, and it didn't melt. It's still intact.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, there's there. Remember during Egwene's testing for Accepted, there was, you know, a resonance from using like Tarangriel in a similar area. Like the dream Tarangriel that she had in her pocket was, you know, affecting the testing Tarangriel. And I'm not wondering if maybe just, yes, they were used or designed to be used as weapons, but they might have only been designed to be used in tandem short term.
Yeah.
And that prolonged use in tandem might have caused just enough feedback that maybe there was a slight flaw in the female version, or maybe because it was the female one that was creating the filter to cleanse the source with. I mean, all he was really doing with the male one was opening the tap and letting it run, you know, letting the faucet run through the filter. You know, the filter was created using Sadar, and therefore, you know, it might have been more active a use, and because it was a more active use, that would be why it melted. I don't know.
Or it could have had something to do with the relative strength of the channelers. I mean, Rand is, after all, the Dragon Reborn, and immensely more powerful than Aeneas, and so he may not have been relying as heavily on the actual Thangreal to pull as Nynaeve was, you know, and that might have had something to do with it. I mean, she's really strong, but she's probably, you know, well, she's not as strong as Olivia, and she's probably not as strong as all of the Forsaken. So, I mean, nobody ever said that Mogedion was one of the strongest of the Forsaken, and she and Nynaeve were equally matched. So it may be that she was pushing it to its absolute limits to keep up with what Rand needed. And that's why she was basically unconscious afterward, and the Tarangriel she was using melted, whereas Rand just basically got up and, well, he wasn't too good a shape either, but he was ready to roll a lot quicker than she was, and his Tarangriel didn't melt. Neither his Tarangriel or his Axis, neither his Axis Key Tarangriel or the statue Tarangriel melted. So, I don't know. That's the only thing I could think of. We're probably never going to know on that one. I don't know if they're going to bother to explain that or not.
I mean, one of the other things to mention in this chapter.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It might just be the difference between male and female stuff, too. I mean, they're just different, so. Sorry, please go on.
You know, one of the other things, and we've mentioned this in previous podcasts and previous summary podcasts, obviously here, there is another tie that Rand is extremely connected to the world, to the land itself. And then, I mean, this is, again, that, you know, when he opens his eyes, the clouds break and the sun shines down on him. And, you know, after this long period of darkness that Rand has been under, and, you know, the darkening mood, with his resolution and his, as we call it, an epiphany, comes a physical change in the environment itself. And so it's definitely significant. There's also a note here from Encyclopedia Wad you know, wondering, is the break temporary, or is there going to be a longer respite from the clouds? You know, how permanent is this particular effect?
Well, there is that, I believe it's a quotation at the header of one chapter having to do with there can be no health in the land, that the land is one with the dragon and the dragon is one with the land, and there can be no health in the land, et cetera, et cetera. And that's obviously what we're seeing here. And it makes me think that we will see not only the clouds breaking, but the land starting to heal itself and produce again as well. You know, maybe crops will start coming in again and so forth and so on. That would certainly be nice. I find it very interesting that there was such an immediate change in his vicinity. The clouds broke and the sun shone over him, and that was quite remarkable. When you think about it, that's another portent in the heavens for anybody who happened to be watching. And it also mentions in the notes about Rand having had his so-called epiphany. And what's he going to be like when I see him again? Is Luthien now permanently gone? I really had a question about it, saying that there are not two men and never were. That certainly seems to fly in the face of everything we've been reading so far. And he said he remembered all of his previous lives. I think he's going to retain any of those memories, like Birgit? Is it something that's going to fade? And maybe this will give him a clue as to how to defeat the Dark One. If he's got memories of all his past lives, he'll know what Luthien did in more detail when they sealed the boar or defeated him. And what about, is this all of the dragon's previous lives? Has Rand always been the dragon reborn, that particular single soul? It seems to be what Ishamiel has always been saying. But if that's so, then he's defeated the Dark One in the so-called last battle any number of cycles of the wheel. Is he going to remember all of that?
Well, I mean, that seems to be the implication, you know, and, you know, the thing is obviously, well, I don't know. I mean, that's, again, there's the question over, you know, he's got that resolution, you know, he can do it over again so that he has a new chance to do things different. You know, he has another chance to save Elenia. He has, you know, another chance to do things differently, and that's part of what keeps the wheel turning, is that there is variation. You know, it's not always the same. And I mean, obviously, if he has knowledge of his previous victories, he also has knowledge of his previous defeat, you know, in such a way. Obviously, the wheel has continued to turn even in the times where the dragon fought for the shadow instead of the light. And, you know, there's so much over the course of the various turnings of the wheel that, you know, you do kind of have to wonder about various things. And you have to wonder if there is a cycle where the dragon wasn't reborn. You know, if, you know, he lived once, died, and then, you know, didn't come back, or worse, you know, died in infancy or something.
Well, that happened when Rand was going through the portal stones. He saw any number of lives where he was born, lived, never realized that he could channel, or if he did realize that he could channel, didn't ever proclaim himself, Moraine never found him. You know, he fought with the Queen's Guards at Camelin, and it threw all of his power against the banner of darkness in the sky. He learned that he could, you know, channel surreptitiously to make things happen in battle. But, you know, he lived and died many times, apparently, without ever proclaiming himself. And each time, you know, he would hear the taunting little voice, "I won again, Luthien." So we have to presume that that's happened. We don't know if those were true revelations of past lives or just, you know, mirror world lives. There's no way to really know for sure. I think they were mirror world lives myself, but because they all seem to be contemporaneous with Rand. In other words, they were all, you know, set in Camelin, Ilion, you know, Egwene, you know, being there as his wife and so forth and so on. So I have to think that they were just, you know, parallel world or mirror world lives, not real ones. But presumably everything that has happened, you know, that can happen has happened at some point in time.
Yeah. The portal stones are weird. Well, we had a good session that we had with Matt Hatch, the Tamerlan of Theoryland, about the metaphysics of the wheel. You know, the
portal stones, Teleron Andriod, etc., that will be coming out eventually.
Probably before I want to
jump back a little bit to the idea that the dragon is one with the land and the land one with the dragon, and whether or not we'll see things getting better. And I'm going to give Towers of Midnight spoilers. It sounds strange to say that, but I'm going to do it anyway.
I was seeing so good, too.
Well, I haven't read the prologue yet, but I have read the free chapters that are available online, Chapter 1, Chapter 8. And if you've read Chapter 1, we see already a marked improvement in the land. In direct response to Rand and his epiphany, we see marked improvement in the land.
So I guess moving on into the epilogue, which is called Dazed in Light. This is from Egwene's point of view, and we find her reading in the Amelin study. All references to Elida have been purged. Sylviana is quite effective as keeper, and the Red Aja seems to have accepted her as a peace offering. She now has stiff opposition from Lelaine and Ramonda, especially over her plan to train the captured Damani as Aes Sedai. Most of the Black Aja in the tower, over 60, escaped, including Evanelion. Siren took a census after the attack, and 40 initiates, over 24 of them Aes Sedai, were taken by the Shanshan. Alina, Chai Rugan, Birion, Pen, and Alviarin escaped. In reswearing the White Tower sisters, they only caught 3 more that Varen missed. From Varen and Sharion, Egwene is convinced that Mesaana was in the tower. However, the list of women missing since the attack and not on Varen's list is short. Nalasia Mirhan, a brown, Teramina, a green, and Jamalia Norshish, a red. All 3 are very weak and have been in the tower for years, so they are all poor candidates to be Mesaana in disguise. Did she leave, or is she somehow still in the tower? Egwene speculates that Mesaana knows how to defeat the Oathrot. Sylviana enters and tells Egwene that there is something she should see. She follows Sylviana to the hall of the tower. Masons are now working the hole in the wall into a window. Through it, she can see that the clouds have broken in a ring around Dragon Mount. The peak of the mountain is bathed in light, the first sunlight she has seen in weeks. She tells Sylviana to mark the calendar. Something has happened, and perhaps someday they will learn what it is, but it's certainly important. Storms are coming, but for now, Egwene is home. And then the footer reads, at the end of time, when the many become one, the last storm shall gather its angry winds to destroy a land already dying. And at its center, the blind man shall stand upon his own grave. There he shall see again and weep for what has been wrought. From the Prophecies of the Dragon, Esonic Cycle, Malavisha's official translation, Imperial Record House of Sundar, Fourth Circle of Elevation.
Again, this is a really kind of straightforward chapter. You know, Egwene has tried to purge the White Tower. A lot of the Black Aja escaped, which is unfortunate. We don't know where Mesaana is. And then we go to the Hall of the Tower, where, and I think this is really interesting. You know, there's this hole busted in the wall so that you can see Dragon Mount. And rather than filling it in, she's putting a window in so that they can always remember, which is a good thing. But why is she putting a rose-colored window in? That is like the rose-tinted glasses. I mean, why?
Oh, did I think it was a rose-colored? I think it was a rose window, and that's a type of stained glass window that is circular in pattern with a geometric design. I don't think it was actually rose-colored. I believe it's what they call
it. I don't know. Let me find it.
I don't have the book in front of me. Sorry.
Oh, she had ordered a rose window. So yeah, you're right. It's rose window, not rose color. Well, I like my interpretation better.
They're very common in cathedrals. Sorry.
I'm sure they are. I still like my interpretation better.
No. Sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know. Having a massive rose-tinted window in a room and that would just serve to, like, make everything kind of red or pink all the time. And I think that would just get on people's nerves and agitate people too much.
No,
I like the idea of the, like, rose window as a...
It would get on the blue nerves and maybe the green. But the Red Aja would be great with it. Oh, yeah.
No.
Do it.
I don't even think they'd be great with it. But rose windows are actually quite beautiful. You can look at, you can Google them. They're in cathedrals and they're usually, you know, stained glass, with frequently, because they couldn't do one huge round window like that. They would have stone traceries in between them or sections of stone in between. And then the rose window itself would have like a center and then pie shaped sections around it with beautiful geometric designs. Sometimes they would have figures and so forth in them as well, but usually they were geometric.
It makes it really hard to see through them, though.
No, it depends on on how to use it. You can use clear glass as part of it as well. And you can see through stained glass. It's just colored. It isn't opaque. It's usually what they call cathedral glass, which is clear but tinted. You can see through them. It's just not, I mean, I don't know how she designed it. If she wanted to see Dragon Mount through it, then she probably did a lot of it in very light colors or clear colors. I mean, a rose window could conceivably be all clear glass as well, but just with traceries of design.
Somehow I doubt that Egwene was actually the one that designed the window, though.
Yeah, I'm sure
she might have an artistic side that we've never seen before, but...
No, but
I am guessing she gave some masons the general idea, this is what I want, and is letting the craftsmen do their job.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure she's...
Yeah, that if she called it no gear.
Yeah. No, I don't think they did
glass. You would have to call
glass.
It some no gear.
They didn't do glass work. I happen to have worked for a stained glass company for many, many years and did tons of stained glass. I actually have windows that I have designed, painted, and fabricated portions of in cathedrals in several different countries, strangely enough. So I know of what I speak. No, she probably didn't do it. She just said, this is what I want, and then they produced it. You know?
Virginia, you are very much a jack-of-all-trades, or a jill-of-all-trades, whichever.
Jack-of-all-trades and master of none, that's me. So, apart from the massive rose-colored window...
Yeah. Well, I had to wonder, too, with not only the damages to the White Tower, but all over Tarvalon, especially with Rockan falling out of the air and crushing buildings and such, if she did send for some Ogier craftsmen to come and help fix the city. I would have, if it were me.
I sure hope so, but the Ogier are all pretty much wrapped up in debating over whether to open the Book of Translation and bug out, so I don't think they're going to be sending any masons anywhere right now.
That doesn't mean that she wouldn't send for some.
I'm sure she would have, but I think that they'll be politely turned away at the borders of the setting, like everybody else has been lately. We're going to have to hope that Royal can speak quickly and well, keep them from, you know, skiving off on us like that. I mean, the world would be a sadder place without the Ogier.
I just hope it doesn't turn out like the Entmoot. That's all I'm saying. Please be a little bit more interesting than several trees spending 12 hours to introduce themselves.
That would be too funny. No, they're too Entish for me, as they are. I'm glad they're
Andrew. Andrew, do you speak Entish?
I'm sure he does. He speaks everything. He's our resident
Entish is
scholar.
One of those complicated languages. Speaking tree is kind of difficult.
All right, so you
don't have the proper amount of leaves and branches? Is that what you're saying?
No, not really. I prefer in readings of the various Tolkien things in which Ents appear to use a combination of voices between what John Rhys-Davies does for Treebeard and what Christopher Lee does for Treebeard in one of the Tolkien Ensemble CDs, which is wonderful.
John Rhys-Davies did Treebeard?
Yes. He was the voice of Treebeard and Gimli.
Well, he wasn't just the voice of Gimli, but I didn't know he did Treebeard.
Yeah.
Shows how much I pay attention.
Well, there you go. So, Andrew, I'm really disappointed. You're telling me you not only don't speak Entish, do you sing to trees at all or anything like that? I mean, what is this?
Yeah, I don't know.
I would love to learn how to tree sing. Then I could, make myself some nice quarterstaves just to beat on people with.
You are an Aiel. You might have that potential once they find the song. You really have to deal with those tinkers, though.
Hey, Loyal already knows the song. I just have to learn it from him.
We don't know that Loyal knows the song. He knows how to sing to trees. He's a tree singer, but he doesn't know the tinker song.
I was meaning the tree songs, not the actual tinker song.
The song, not the song.
Yeah, not the song with a capital T and S.
Explain to me why that Egwene has done two things are happening here. They've purged all references to Elida. That seems like kind of non-transparency to me.
Oh, well, if you actually read the text, it says that someone went through the Amarlin office and got rid of all of Elida's stuff so that it wouldn't offend Egwene. They didn't actually go through the histories and say, no, Elida O'Rohan never existed. No, they didn't do that.
Okay, so again, we're reading this from Encyclopedia Watt, and I apologize because I didn't really look it up. And so we should actually make a big deal about it because it isn't. When I read that, I thought, what, they took that out of the histories? I don't remember that. That'd be kind of, you know, cheesy, really. So okay,
kind of cheating
references. But yeah, they did that a lot. The Aes Sedai, they were really sneaky that way. That's why the hidden histories in the 13th depository are secret and treason to reveal and all this kind of stuff. They didn't let
that,
anything
that's
out.
That's why that's why the Aes Sedai never sent anyone to Malkieri.
Well, they
we
did.
Know how
they
that.
Just got there.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
They got there too
exactly.
late. They got there too late.
Well, and then because they didn't want to admit they had failed, they struck it from the histories.
Right. But they just didn't admit it.
Yep. But I think Egwene would have major problems with that. But it did say that they got all of Elida's stuff out of the Ammerlin office, everything that for a hint of Elida so that it wouldn't offend Egwene. And then she was like, no, save that stuff so that we can look through it and make sure that, just see what she was planning, please.
Yeah, save that stuff so that I can go through it and see what she was planning, and then I'm going to go through and break it all into 1,000 shards by hand, not using the one power, break it into pieces, bam, with a sledgehammer.
Ooh, sledgehammers.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, as Morgadian said, sometimes doing things physically as its attractions.
Well, you just take it to the top of the Ammerlin Palace that is mostly constructed, just sit on top of the spire and start chucking it off, and then you take down the Ammerlin Palace and use the materials to, you know, build some affordable housing.
on the grounds of the tower, affordable housing. I didn't think they got past the foundations on her palace, did they?
Didn't they have the middle spire up, the really high one that went above the tower?
I
remember seeing that at some point in time. Maybe it was just in Elida's imagination.
I think it was in her fevered imagination. I can tell you that Sufi the Demon, is it Sufi the Demoni now? It's not going to be having
I think it's
palaces.
Sufa.
Sufa, okay. She's not going to be having any palaces anytime soon. Oh, I hope they break her and break her hard.
I don't want the Shanchan to have traveling and a lot of these other things that Elida knows that we don't want the Shanchan to.
I think that's pretty much, you know, the cat's amongst the pixies now, if I may do a little Harry Potter crossover. I think the traveling's out. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
So why is she still having stiff opposition from Elaine and Ramonda? What's up with those
because
two? Are they never
going to
give up? They're never?
They are power-mongering better than thou annoyances.
She can defeat the entire... She can purge the entire Black Aja and behead people right and left, and she can't set Lelaine and Ramonda down in their places?
She brought the tower back together, but Lelaine and Ramonda, she just needs to slap, give them penance, and by penance, I don't mean, oh, it's a penance. I mean, send them to a farm, for heaven's sakes. Keep them there.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? Maybe they can
send
find
them
good
to the funny farm.
Yeah, maybe we can find good old Mistress DeWheel that Tovain was working under for so long. She seemed to have been a pretty tough cookie.
And their bedroom is a small room with two beds that they must share.
Yeah.
And
one bed that they must share. elbows and all. Yeah, that would be perfect.
And they work in a mud field.
Yep, just a mud field.
Their warders are not allowed to help them.
Just growing mud?
Yes, that's what Dachoval. Of course, they get the Dachoval treatment. They dig holes and then fill them back in. They move rocks from one side of the field to the other and then back, and et cetera.
No. I got a better idea. Yeah, you're right. You're on the right track. I think she needs to send them to Sorrelia, have them declared Dachoval, and put to work in black robes, eternally doing useless and shaming labor. Oh yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that would work for Elida, too, if we get her back. I think she definitely needs to go to Sorrelia.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Dot song. You are
maybe
Dot song.
Not the black robes, because those are just a little... Yeah. And definitely not for eternity, because Thy Song, can't they regain their honor eventually?
No, it's almost impossible. It can happen, but it's nearly impossible. Black robes, and not only that, the itchiest, scratchiest black robes that they can find. And I don't care if they pour a little itch-oak down them as well. I really don't like Elida. I really don't.
But Ramonda and Lelaine, really?
Yeah, they're pretty annoying. Maybe Lelaine, since she was kind of good to Sawan a couple of times, she might get a pass, but Ramonda has almost no redeeming features. She's not even that great a healer, so get over yourself,
hey,
woman.
She's the one that figured out that Halima and the sitter who starts with a D that I can't remember.
Delana Mosalane. Yeah.
Yeah. Her.
Okay. After she had her nose rubbed in it, she figured it out. Duh. That wasn't any great leap of investigative reporting on her part. It's not good enough. Not enough.
Okay. If you say so.
All right, but we can just send Lelaine to Sylviana, and Ramonda and Elida can share the bed on the farm with Zoralia, pushing rocks back and forth forever, carrying water in a spoon and getting beaten when they spill a drop. Sylviana can do for Lelaine. She wasn't quite as bad. Oh, Egwene is home now. Isn't that great? She's the
Maybe we should
Leo.
Maybe we should just give one of them to Thrava.
Yeah, but that would mean having to deal with Thrava again, too. No, I'd rather just let her go and never come back. I'm glad she's got Galena, and her life will be a living hell now, but I don't want to see Thrava anymore. Thanks very much. Not enough. I don't even hate Elida enough to track down Thrava.
Yeah. You know, there are times when I think about Galena with Thrava, and I feel pity for her. And then I remember Dumai's Wells and everything that led up to it. And
yeah,
I
feel all warm
I don't
and
pity,
fuzzy.
And yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I feel all warm and fuzzy inside. Ah, Galena, you're right where you belong. Yeah. That black robe. Forever and ever. Hallelujah.
Or no robes. They have her in that every once in a while, too.
Oh, what? I don't, did she, wait a minute, now, and she's not still in the silks anymore. They don't need her for that.
Well, do we have anything more to say about Just Another Man or Veins of Gold or the epilogue?
No, I think we're fairly good.
No,
okay.
I got one quickie here. This passage about most of the Black Aja in the tower, over 60, escape, and they include, at least in the summary here, Evan Island. By name, why is she significant? Oh, I must confess that my memory has failed me. Why was Evan Nyland?
She
a sitter?
She was a sitter for the Grey Aja.
Okay,
She was part of Elida's party that took Suwon into custody. Yeah.
So she was a sitter.
And
that's
she's part of Elida's council.
Yeah. 60? I had forgotten. I thought she... I know they only found three more that Varen had missed, but I didn't realize I had forgotten that so many of them escaped. I'm doing my reread again. I'm almost done with Winter's Heart. In fact, I was just on the part where I was cleansing Sidene when we started the call.
That was the after effect of what you mentioned what was mentioned in our last podcast, that doing the, by having anybody escape from the Saladar cleansing, or the rebel camp cleansing, word was going to get to the tower, and, you know, enough of it got through that enough people were able to flee sooner, so.
Yeah, so we still got
and it, honestly, I think that Egwene made a big mistake there. I think she was way too furious about the Black Aja information she had and went after him with too much gusto. She should have waited until after the tower was reunited and then done the cleansing. Because once the tower is reunited, then you have them all, and you can have the tower guard and Gareth Bryn's army and several of the warders that you trust holding the exits and entrances so that they can't get in or out. Although traveling is still a problem.
Well, yeah, because we know the Black Aja had that, so. Or at least some of them. We don't know how many.
Well, we know that some of the ones that escaped from Saladar, they traveled out because Brian was surrounding the camp, and they were not, they could have snuck out that way, but.
Well,
they traveled away.
Egwene gave traveling to everybody in Saladar who was strong enough to do it, and those that weren't could link together to open a gateway, so that was a done deal, but the tower, Aes Sedai, very few of them had it. Alviarn was forbidden to tell anybody else by Mesaana, and Elida kept it held fairly close. I think, you know, Bannon obviously knew, and she told a few people, and Katarine and a few others knew, but most of the Tauri said I did not know how to travel. Yeah, but yeah, I think you're right. She was precipitous.
Oh, you know what she should have done? You know the way she should have done it? Is she should have gotten one of the wells that either Cad Swain or Nynaeve have. Then she should have taken all of the sisters into a setting. Had the setting surrounded. Had the setting surrounded so they can't travel away, but because of the well, they can still use the oath rod.
You know, well, one thing, I don't think the well would have lasted that long to unswear and re-swear all of those sisters. And secondly, I think the Ogier might have had a thing or two to say about that. I don't
think abandoned
steadings. Yeah, go to one of the abandoned steadings.
All right. But yeah, so what is she going to do? Say, okay, everybody, it's field trip time.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. That'd work. I think some of them would have
just fill them out of their beds.
Anybody wants to know, if you sign up for a free trial of audible.com, you can get one complete book, which would be worth something like $60. And right now, one of the complete books that you can get for your free trial is The Way of Kings. So you can download the entire Audible book. You've got a 14-day free trial and your one free credit. And so there you go. If you want the audio version of Brandon's Way of Kings, go for it.
And of course, with audible.com, there are several things online that if you sign up through them basically, or they're in partnership with Audible. I'm not entirely sure how it works, but if you sign up through them, then you're helping them. I know that Brandon's Writing Excuses has this. I think there are some other podcasts out there that do this. Maybe we should. I don't know. But if you sign up through them, so you might, rather than just going out and saying, oh, free 14-day free trial, you might want to check with some of your favorite, content, whether it be podcasts or what have you, and just see if you can help them out that way.
Cool. I actually did.
Just
because
it's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
I kind of want to pimp out now that we're talking about Way of Kings, the 17th Shard, which is well on its way to becoming the Dragon Mount of Stormlight Archive. So you should go check them out.
Any closing comments now that we've finished our read-through of The Gathering Storm?
Actually, I do have one thing that I need to mention. A few episodes back, I made a reference to a song lyric. It was in deference to Rand's destruction of Natron's Barrow. And I misquoted both the title of the musical it was from and the title of the song it was from, and so I really should probably make that correction. The musical itself is only titled Hyde. I actually added Jekyll in there, and it is just Hyde, and the title of the song from which the lyric appears is Alive, not I Need to Know. Those are just a couple of things that I noticed the other day as I was listening through that particular soundtrack, and I went, you know what, that needs to be corrected.
That's really, really funny, because I was just listening to the soundtrack of Dr. Horrible again, and I cannot now hear A Brand New Day without thinking of Natron's Barrow. Sorry. It's forever linked in my mind.
Now we finished our recap of The Gathering Storm, comparing it to the other books in the novel, which is kind of interesting, but we're doing it anyway. I'm going to ask you anyway. Out of 13 access keys, what do you give it?
Ooh, 13 access keys, huh? I'd give it an 11.
Andrew?
I'm going to have to put it relatively high. It is one of my favorite books in the series, particularly after the long stretch where some of those middle books are a little difficult to get through. I'm going to have to put it probably in... I'm going to have to rate it fairly high. Out of 13, it's probably going to have to be probably somewhere between 10 and 12.
Wouldn't that be 11, between 10 and 12? Anyway.
It might be. It depends on what...
It also depends on if I can have melted half... It also depends on if I can have melted half Tarangriel.
You can. We saw them in the Tarsan Palace, so yes, you can have half access key.
Okay, then I give it 11 and one half melted Tarangriel.
Oh, yeah. I think it's actually pretty good. I think that'll work for me as well.
Yeah.
11 and a half. Yeah. I may not be the best judge of this because I haven't done a reread of the books, especially in the middle, for a couple of years now. But you're right. It is really, really good. It's really powerful. It's definitely up there. So I think I'm gonna have to join you with the 11.5 access key Tarangriel somehow.
I think if it hadn't been
cut them in half.
I have to think if it hadn't been for the fact that Brandon's sort of still finding the voice on a couple of the characters, it would have probably been a 13 just because of a couple of chapters for Egwene, obviously, and Rand. So good. So powerful. Yeah. It actually probably deserves a 13. But I still have some problems with a couple of the chapters, especially the Matt ones. It wasn't Matt to me. It was close. It was really close. And I cannot complain. I can't complain. Brandon did an amazing, amazing job trying to fill some really big shoes in a really fairly short period of time. And boy, you know what? He promised us a book in a year and he delivered. He delivered in spades. So, I mean, you're never going to get a criticism of Brandon for me. I mean, I have to, you know, what is, and something isn't quite itself. It isn't quite itself, but man, what an effort, what a mighty effort that was. So, yeah, it probably deserves really a 13. But I'll still stick with the 11.5 just because, being a stupid little critic, I have to pick up my little nitpicky thing. And Varen died. I was really sad about that. So, yeah, if Varen hadn't died, then, I don't know, maybe a 14.
Only maybe?
Yeah, I miss Varen. I understand we're going to see a little bit of her as a flashback in the next book. I hope that's true.
Well, if for any reason she visits a character that we have a point of view from before she dies, that we haven't seen already, because we've already seen her visit Matt, we've seen her visit Egwene, but she had several letters, so, you know, she could be visiting Perrin, she could be visiting Nalaine, she could be visiting any number of minor characters that we've only got one or two point of views from before. Gotten a point of view from before, and we'll suddenly get one just to see Varen.
It would maybe have been a 15 if we'd have managed to have the Towers of Genji scenes in this book, which I was really expecting.
Oh, my. Okay.
Next time. So
next
I had
time.
another year of anticipatory delight.
Well, go ahead.
One thing I do say is that I think between you and me and the listeners, we are definitely going to start our Towers of Midnight read through a lot sooner. Next time.
Oh, yeah.
Like maybe January.
It depends on when it's coming out, because if you've read the latest, not the latest blog post, but a recent blog post from Brandon, it sounds like because he has to take some time to rest and recuperate from this year, where he came out with two epic novels.
I know.
And so he's going to take a little break from writing epic fantasy. He's writing some fun stuff now that we may or may not ever see. Just some fun stuff. And so it could be 2012 before we actually see A Memory of Light. But
okay.
Still, I mean, really? In just a little over a year, we're going to get the end? Oh, my gosh.
Hello.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
What am I going to do with my life?
I don't know. So young and life already over.
I know.
Well, we'll have all of Brandon's stuff to look forward to. I just wonder.
Stormlight Archive, baby. Well, I think that's going to be it for our Gathering Storm. The Gathering Storm. Is it The Gathering Storm or just Gathering Storm? It's The Gathering Storm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. TGS. The Gathering Storm recap. 13 episodes of pure awesome. Sometimes.
Well, we hope.
Yeah, we hope. We hope that this will satiate some of your...
Awesome.
Yeah.
And we hope you enjoy it. We hope you've liked it and enjoyed coming along on this ride with us.
Yep, and you are going to get a whole bunch of podcasts delivered all at one time, and we promise that after this, there are not going to be so many delays. Just things happen.
Of course, there are a number of ways you can always get a hold of us if you want to pitch us crazy theories or give us comments, feedback, criticism, anything you want. And those, of course, will be posted at the end of this particular podcast.
All right. So I think that'll wrap up this exciting episode. And thank you for sticking with us through hopefully the entire Gathering Storm read through. It's been a lot of fun. And we're going to get to do it all again pretty soon. Hours of Midnight coming soon. Can't wait. Can't wait. So that'll do it for this episode. Thank you once again for joining us. We really appreciate your listenership. We hope you enjoy listening to us talking about our favorite fantasy series as much as you do. We love doing it. So anyway, until we meet again, this is Virginia, hoping that the light will illumine you.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Soravianento Manjima, Taishite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. To contact us, visit our website, DragonMount.com/podcast.
Really? The wheel's already been started? It's amazing.
The wheel is turning all the time. The wheel turns on and on. It's sort of like the road goes ever on and on. The wheel turns ever on and on.
How far away the wheel has gone. But I must follow it back home.
First, we want to take care of a couple things. The first is our customary spoiler warning. If the children will stop screaming in the background.
But I don't wanna.
I kind of feel like we should have We Are the Champions playing in the background as we're doing all this
thank
you stuff.
No kidding.